Mr. Levitt, Regal 3. I've got in front of me the badge we were talking about earlier that you were sent, and it's a little shield-shaped badge, red in the top two-thirds and blue in the bottom third, with a silver crown at the top. And underneath, there are five numbers going downwards vertically. They're 1, 0, 3, and going horizontally from left to right, they're 202. What are the significance of the numbers?
I'm afraid I don't know now. Oh, yes, I'm sorry, I said earlier. Actually, one I understood was for the underground movement.
The number one.
And the other way were those that were involved in watching the specialists to notify these people in the event of invasion for planes or tanks. There was a lookouts around the coast, but we were never involved with the lookouts. We were completely separate, and I was only told this by someone during the period of time I was there, but I can't recollect who it was.
So the number one relates to what you were doing?
I'm not sure which way it is. I expect so, the one reading down. I wouldn't like to say.
Let me put
in the Wisbeach, Hobeach area, a group officer was a Bill Grounds. He was an accountant. Now, the meetings held in a small pub in Boston. For the times I used to take it around, explain all this explosive stuff, etc. There used to be a little group of four or five, and this particular pub was called the Flower Pot in the centre of Boston, and it probably belonged to Bill Ground's mother, so we could always have a little private room and out of the way of the general public. Now, talking about the foggy nights, just to give you one incident, I was at King's Lynn for a meeting from 7 until 9, and I had arranged to pick up a corporal and a lance corporal on Boston Bridge sometime about 10:30, and they had been to a unit showing them the equipment to wear in the event of need and camouflage, etc., etc. And it was a very, very foggy night when the meeting finished, and it took me from 9 o'clock until 2 o'clock in the morning to get from from King's Lynn to Boston Bridge. Now, when I arrived there, the corporal and lance corporal were still waiting for me, and they obviously got no way of getting anywhere else. They knew I'd turn up eventually. And while they were on the bridge, a policeman came by about midnight, and he said, "Hello, what are you two chappies?" They were in uniform, by the way. "What are you two chappies doing?" So Corporal Irison had got some incendiaries and detonators and things to explain, and little bits of primer cord and gun cotton slab and the primer for it. And when the policeman said, "What have you got in the bag?" Corporal Irison laughed and said, "Oh," he said, "we've got some explosives here." So, the policeman laughed at him and said, "Oh, well, all right. Anyhow, good night," and he wandered off. I often wonder what would have happened if he'd have looked in the bag. Right. Now, Mr. Clark was a group commander in the Boston area, and he was a Fens drainage officer, and he was a very important person because he could supply the information regarding the tides, etc., over large areas of Fens, especially in the Butterwick area. And this was a great help to Captain Lamb, because he realised that when the tides were in or out, whether it would be suitable for boats to come in from the French coast. Now, I don't know quite what he was. Obviously, I wasn't told by Captain Lamb about these things, but quite often I had to carry private mail from Captain Lamb down to Boston and to hand it personally to Mr. Clark. Now, a Mr. Grant was Mr. Clark's group leader in Swine's Head, near Boston, of his group. Now, there was a Mr. Proctor, that was mentioned earlier, was sleeping in the chicken house. He died some years ago, and his son, was Robin, was approximately 6 to 8 years old at this time. He was very, very interested, and a young lad, but he was very, very keen, and he was very interested in the night. When four of us one night slept in his father's chicken house, I'm sure as he grew older that his father would have explained our presence. He was maybe a president, or maybe is, president of the NFU for the Lincolnshire Farmers Union. This information I obtained when my wife and I visited the Royal Show at Warwick Stoney some years ago. I mention this in case anyone at any time wishes to kind of check up on these things. Anyhow, the prisoner group further north was in charge of the groups in that area were two farmers. They were brothers, both unmarried, but they had a housekeeper, but I'm sorry I cannot remember their names. Now, in the Brig area with their units, stayed with a Bib Brocklesby whilst in this area. Cannot remember clear details. Maybe this was the OB that was flooded at a later date. I was sent out by Captain Lamb to collect the group together and blow up the OB. I explained how I was going to do this. The water was 4 to 5 foot high. The stores had already been removed by the group. Having plenty of 808 cartridges, I and the group commander taped 808 explosive cartridges end-to-end, approximately 1 foot above the end-to-end to Cortex primer cord, approximately 1 foot above the water level, right around the inside of the OB. Now, this explosive detonated approximately 6,000 metres per second. The group was shown these fittings and retired approximately 250 to 300 yards away. Then the group commander and I fitted approximately 20 foot of safety fuse to each end of the Cortex, each of us lighting one end of the safety fuse and walked slowly back to the group. This was to kind of prove to them that when you put a fuse or any description onto an explosive charge, there's no need to run away. You just gave yourself plenty of time to stroll back to where you'd got cover. Now, I told them immediately the bang went off to stand up. They had obviously steel helmets on, to look up, and if any pieces were falling near them, to move to one side, avoid being hit. The idea, you just watched them. You never did that kind of thing. Anyhow, pieces of concrete reached 200 to 300 foot in height and spread over quite a large area. And the concrete was actually made completely of concrete, including the roof in this particular instance, because it was only kind of 2 foot above the ground, more like a kind of a gun concrete that they used corners of roads, etc., etc., in the event of machine guns.
Why was it that you were blowing up this operating area?
It was waterlogged. 4 foot of water, I said. Okay? And now they couldn't live in it. And you see, it was in an area where when there was heavy rains in the winter, it got flooded.
It was useless.
So they had to do away with that. Now, the group thanked me for a very interesting day. And the farmer promised to bulldoze the concrete into the hole, which was a large one, and cover up with earth. The field was a grass one, so no problem there. Now, Mr. Andrews, Great Barton on the Humber, the usual type of meeting at his house, all groups, explaining all the incendiaries, etc., etc. And all these surroundings were so well camouflaged or in such positions so that no one would suspect that anything at all could be going on in any way, shape or form. There was nothing to show the footsteps trailing here or trailing down, because they're always very, very well recovered very carefully, because with a wire supporting the grass sods onto the wooden cover, never showed any difference or in any way that there was something below this particular spot. Now, that's a rough summary of our activities over a period of approximately 1 year when invasion was imminent. Now, at this time, large groups met at Dolby Hall for weekends, exercises, placing charges on tracks of a railway, timber, etc., etc., so that they could be explained the difference between cutting metal, which was the gun cotton slabs, PHE, or the type of metal that was used for lifting. For instance, if you was going to kind of blow a bridge up across a river and that kind of thing, you would want a bridge. Darn me, I forget the name at the moment. I'll mention that later on, of the different types, which exploded roughly at about a 3,300. 500 meters per second, and they had a kind of a spreading rather than a cutting effect. For instance, the gun cotton slab, if you put one side of the rail and one the other, and it would cut it like a knife, where if you put these others on, it would just bend the rail and lift it, which was no good at all, really. Now, when this unit was ordered to be dismantled, an RE captain came to Dolby Hall to destroy the explosives in the centre of Seton that I had. Now, he'd never seen the types of booby traps and the different explosives and the incendiaries, phosphorus or grenades, for instance, he'd never seen, instead of the ordinary one. We obviously had both. And once a phosphorus one, you couldn't throw it like the other grenade, you had to just cook it underarm and keep it to so that the spring was so weak inside, in no way could it jerk and fire off this delicate mechanism, because otherwise you'd have been covered yourself with phosphorus. So it had to be kind of held sideways and cooked. So you could only use this in a very close where the fuel dumps were or whatever, things like that, food. To do any damage, and of course you hadn't got any time to get away, so they were very, very seldom used. Now, to give you a rough idea of the equipment, approximately I had 1,000 Molotov cocktails. They had safety match heads. There was a type of a lemonade bottle pre-war, and they were quite safe to carry. Haversack or whatever when these people went out, and all they had to do was just strike the safety match on a kind of a pad which was made up the same ingredients as you know, safety match box. I had several hundred grenades and phosphorus hand grenades. I had 500 to 600 phosphorus incendiary phosphorus bombs, which were like a very large torch, again started off with a match head, and no way once one started then away they went. Now, I also had 500 bottles or more of a paraffin type rubber type bottle, and they were nice and light to carry in comparison to the others, and they also had a match head type. They were filled with paraffin. The TNT 4-ounce primers had for putting in tanks for the tanks that were put on the roads through the woods or pathways, and because they were also used in the way to protect where your OB was or where their traffic in any way, shape or form or people were likely to be moving. They also had plastic HE, which was very, very, very nice. It's just like plasticine, and you could literally, having prepared it all, take a detonator out of the little special type Bakelite containers that you could screw the top half off, and they were individually placed in separate little sections. And you just crimped this detonator onto your length of cortex in straight into your plastic molded to shape explosives. These gun cotton slabs, approximately, to give you some idea, detonated 6,700 meters per second, and the plastic HE approximately 8,000 meters per second. All the word I was searching for spreading instead of cutting was aminal, that this detonated approximately 6,300 meters per second. So you can show how slow it was in comparison to the cutting. Especially the PHE at 8,000.
PHE?
Plastic high explosive. All right. The 1,000 Molotov cocktail bottles were taken by truck because the officer was so nervous of all this equipment I'd got, he didn't know what to do with it, and he said to me, can you get rid of it? So I said, I can get rid of it. So I said, I can take it down onto the Butterwick marshes and different times and destroy it quite safely. So he thanked me very, very much for that. I never knew his name. I never saw him again. So who he was, I've got no way of knowing. But obviously HQ, whoever sent him, if this was necessary to be all verified, well, it could be easily done, I would imagine. There must be records somewhere.
When was it that you were getting rid of all this stuff?
This was after D-Day, when there was no fear of any invasion. Okay?
You said that you were with this unit about a year.
Yes.
So was it 43, 44 that you were in this unit?
44.
Did you
the
start
whole of
it?
End of 43, as far as I recollect. And
you,
I was there until 44. Yes.
At the end of 43.
Yes, they had got these units in place at this time. And I was given to understand by Captain Greenwood, he was in charge of the Butterwick group, that he wasn't too good with his explosion incendiaries. And they were very relieved when I gave this first lecture at Dolby Hall. Captain Lamb had arranged when approximately 40 of these people came up in a large group. And they all said how nice it was that somebody could really explain all the different types of things and their uses, which was very, very nice as far as I was concerned. Certainly just the opposite type of feeling you got with these people, who were very dedicated, by the way, and very keen and most reliable in all ways, I found out at later dates. And one couldn't do enough for them, and they couldn't do enough for you. So it was a good kick-off for me, and I thoroughly enjoyed my period with these people. Going back to... Mr. Greenwood, by the way, was a schoolmaster, and although I saw him once in uniform, I'm not sure whether he was a territorial, or whether he was the First World War, or whether he was going out... leaving the schoolmasters with his wife, who was also the mistress, at Butterwick. So I'm afraid I don't know what happened there. Anyhow, these Molotov cocktails, the bottles were placed one neck under, one neck over, a long length of cortex in a large U shape. I crimped on a detonator to each end of a safety fuse, taped the detonators to each end of the cortex. Now, each safety fuse was very long because, being a flat area and with the amount of bottles to be destroyed, I decided I might as well have it, enjoy myself and have it all go in one lot rather than lots of little lots. And when these were all arranged, the driver with his truck, they went approximately 1.5 miles away into a kind of a hollow, and I took, and having plenty of it, yards and yards, coils of it, safety fuse, I walked back to the truck and we took shelter in a very large hollow. The blast resulted with a black mushroom type of atom bomb cloud, and several hundreds of feet high rose into the air, solid and then spreading like a terrific mushroom. Soon after, approximately half an hour, in a car from Boston, arrived a group of officers in charge of the fire depot in Boston, and they look out on the top of the building, the fire station, which I understand was always somebody on duty. He warned them that there was something happening on Butterwick Marshes, and when this officer got out of his car and the chaps wanted to know what it was all about, he said, in their words, "It frightened them to death, and would I please notify them if I had any future demolitions to do?" So we had a chat about it, and he wanted to know why. So I said, well, it's some old army stuff they wanted to get rid of. But of course there was no raid on, so they really were and couldn't understand on the marshes what all this problem was. Anyhow, all other explosives I destroyed in smaller amounts, some on the marshes, some at Dolby, including all incendiaries, booby traps, wires, revolvers and all equipment handed in. The office to dispose of the holding. Now, when this was all safely either destroyed or handed in, I was then posted to Halifax, a holding unit. Now, later from the holding unit at Halifax, I was sent to Aldershot.
Does this finish your guerrilla
at the moment?
Now?
Yes. So shall I?
Did you go back to the guerrilla work?
No.
Could I just ask you some more questions about the guerrilla work?
Yeah.
You obviously, after D-Day, the threat of a German invasion was no longer credible. Mm. So you were just spending time disposing of all the equipment that had been built up over the years.
Yes. There was, prior to all this, which I think you might be very interested in, that when I was down in the Wisbeach area, looking at and giving lectures, I called in name's here somewhere, Kelly Martin, a farmer, one afternoon, and I had an evening meeting, as I thought, and when I arrived there, he was out in the field. He came in about five, and he said, "Hello, Corp, what are you doing?" So I said, "Well, I'll come round to inspect one of the OBs as well." I said, "In the area," I said, "we've got another one to do tomorrow." I was at this time. I'd been out on all day. I was in my kind of motor cycle outfit, a helmet and waders kind of thing. And my suit, having been out a couple of days, without going back to the unit, was rather creased and crumpled. So he said, "Bill," he said, "we've got an RE major home on leave from Africa. He's Monty's right-hand man. He was the son of the vicar, he said, and we're having a kind of a party, a celebration for him coming home." So he said, "Now," he said, "he's an RE, so obviously," he said, "I'd like you to come along." So I said, "Well, I can't come along." I said, "I'm in a state." I said, "I've got army boots on under these waders and that." And he said, "Well, that's all right." He said, "We'll fit you up." So he said, "What shoes do you take?" And he was a chap who always said, "Bugger me, bugger this," and didn't mean a thing. "Oh," he said, "bugger me." He said, "I've got a pair of nines upstairs." He said, "Brand new, never worn. They'll do for you." So I said, "Well, I'll tell you what I'll do then, Kelly, I said, if I can kind of take my suit off and press it to look reasonable, I said, because I couldn't go to as rough as I was to any reception, I'll come along. So he said, all right. He said, take your trousers off, I'll get the maid to iron them. I said, no. I said, put me in a room with an iron. I said, I'll take them off and do them myself. So this I did, and this must have been about 5 to 6 in the evening. And when he first came in, he said, by the way, he said, have you had any tea? I said, no. I said, have you had any lunch yet? So he said, oh, be me. He said, we'll soon sort you out. So his wife cooked me a couple of eggs on a large plate of ham. And that's the thing I really remember as well. Anyhow, eventually, after the vicar, his son, and I was introduced to them, and the vicar's wife, came in for pre-drinks to the concert, party. We then walked along to the hall, which was only about 100 yards away, carrying jellies and trifles. By the way, plenty of sherry in them, and all kind of cakes, etc., etc. And these also were swelled by the other people in the village that were in the hall at the time and still arriving. And the vicar and his family and Kelly Martin sat on a roundish or oblong table in the centre of the hall, and all the little tables, etc., with the rest of the village were spread around. Now, this was a wonderful evening. I was made to sit on the R.E. Major's right hand, and he said it was an honour for me to be in the area and doing what I was.
Because he knew about this kind of guerrilla
activity? He only knew a little of it. He knew of it, but he didn't really know anything about it.
But it was supposed to be secret.
Yes, yes. Well, he only knew of it, I think, when I brought it up, prior to going to the party.
Can I just ask you about the date when you started doing this work? Because you said it was the end of 43.
Then there's something next. I tried to get my records.
I don't mean the exact date, but the fact that even at this relatively late stage in the war, after all, it was only about half a year or 9 months before D-Day, they were still concerned about the possibility of a German invasion.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, so definitely right up to the time I left. It was some weeks it must have been.
So you joined it at this late stage of its history, this guerrilla unit. Did you learn anything whilst you were with the unit about the history of the unit in the earlier days before you joined it, about who'd been in charge or anything of that kind?
No idea at all. Because this was just dealt with a kind of a day by day, and you were never kind of told anything you were not involved in, and you was never discussed in any way, shape or form, or why or what the unit, right from the time joining to leaving.
But earlier on you mentioned the name of Major General Colin Gubbins. How did you know that he was...